Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello everyone, you're listening to What's the Crack, and today I'm interviewing Jenny Valentich, the author of Woman of Substances, which is available today on Amazon. Today with Jenny, we find out what's the crack with her new book, The Media's Representation of Women and Drugs, Jenny's own experience with the media, male-focused drug research and treatment, and what's the crack with all the language used. I hope you enjoy the episode, and remember to follow us on Twitter at WhatTheCrackPod. Enjoy! Okay, so let's begin. And could you start by telling me a bit about yourself and what you do?
My name's Jenny Valentich. I'm the author of Women of Substances, A Journey into Drugs, Alcohol and Treatment. I grew up in Slough in the UK and now I live in Australia. I started out as a music journalist and now I write about music, culture, current affairs, but a lot about drugs and alcohol as well.
Great, thank you. So, as you said, you just recently released a book called Woman of Substances. Could you summarise as best as you can to our listeners what the book is actually about?
Yeah, it was very much the book I needed when I was younger. So I wanted to get answers to all the questions I had about why my drinking and drug use got quite out of control and why I sort of never learnt from the mistakes that you'd think that you should learn from. So it's partly research. I went around Australia and the UK talking to academics, and researchers, clinicians, people who work on the front line of drugs and alcohol. But it's also addiction memoir in that I use vignettes from my own back catalogue to illustrate my points. But it's very different to your average addiction memoir in that it doesn't end up with, you know, redemption and AA and talking in a very different language to the one that you started in.
Great, thank you. And within your book that I've read and I really like, you make a point of saying that it's not your typical redemption, rock bottom to redemption storyline. Is there a reason why you felt that it needed to be said that this wasn't your typical story?
I find it quite reductive the way that all we hear in the media, for instance, about people who use drugs is we hear about the people who reach rock bottom, they lost everything, but now they're okay. And it's like we can approve of them now. So it's this real kind of paternalistic look at what drug use and sobriety is like. And I just wanted to avoid that because it's really reductive and simplistic. So, for instance, I drink now happily after 8 years of not drinking. So while I'm not sort of advocating that people try that if they've given it up, I wanted to illustrate the point that it's not necessarily all about abstinence and, you know, once you quit, that's it, and your life follows a certain path. I just wanted to give more nuance to the usual kind of narratives.
Yeah, that's great, because I think that it's kind of lost in stories. And you are right that there is that rock bottom to redemption storyline that's used a lot. And it's, I feel like it puts a lot of pressure on people for like, if they don't get that redemption storyline, then they haven't done recovery or whatever word we will use for that. They haven't succeeded in, you know, removing themselves from a life with drugs. It's like, oh, well, I'm not sober for, you know, all my life. Therefore I haven't done it right.
It's also, I mean, apart from the fact that it's a very Christian storyline, it's also implying that your life when you were taking drugs was terrible, useless, you're a bad person. And it's only in quitting that you've become acceptable, whereas that might not be a case at all. You might have been a really good mum, or you might have been, you know, someone who was just struggling with a lot of pain. But it doesn't mean that you've suddenly become a better person now that you've quit.
Yeah. You are a part of the Alcohol and Other Drugs Media. Could you explain what this organisation is? And I guess with regards to your book and drug use in the media, why is it important that it exists?
So it's an Australian group. It's called AOD, Alcohol and Other Drug Media Watch, which is kind of a pun on a program called ABC Media Watch, which takes publications to task for bad reporting. So we're kind of doing the same thing, and a lot of mental health charities do this as well, where we're a group of professionals. So other people in the group are drug and alcohol researchers, ex-law enforcement, that kind of thing. And we look out for news stories that are salacious about drugs or inaccurate. You know, maybe they're rushing to identify pills that have been responsible for an overdose, but they're misidentifying them. Or stigmatizing. Stigmatizing is a really big one for us. So what we do is we look out for those stories, mainly in the Australian media. And then one of us will write a response, or a member of the public will write a response. And then that's peer reviewed by two others. And then we contact the original journalist who wrote the story, and we ask them if they want to have a right of reply. And we try and just open a conversation about what irresponsible reporting about drug use looks like and what responsible reporting looks like. And we offer resources as well. So, you know, journalists can actually come to us and we'll put them in touch with researchers and experts to help them write an accurate story.
Okay, so what has been your experience in the media with your own book release and your own Alcohol and Other Drugs story?
It's been what I anticipated it would be, but that's still been really difficult. Being a journalist myself, I kind of knew what angles that the press were going to go with. And invariably, they've all gone with 4 pages of the book, which is about childhood sexual abuse. So I don't think I've ever managed to escape that in an article, actually. So it usually starts with that in the first paragraph. Sometimes it will... The first paragraph will be basically a list of the worst things that have ever happened to me. Eventually we might get to something, you know, a bit more about the research. But it's been really tricky, because it seems, I think, to the public as though I've written one of those misery memoirs that you get in airports, you know, like Daddy sold me for a pack of smokes. So again, it's really going for that titillating angle, whereas in fact, you know, I'd say a good half of the book is research, and I've only used my own story to illustrate the points. So that's been really tricky, particularly if you go and do, you know, a radio interview. You've got about 8 minutes. You're in there, you're in and out like a SWAT team, and they just want you to cough up this furball of trauma immediately. And then sometimes you're then allowed to talk about the research, but you've already been kind of set up as this tragic figure, so it's very hard to change hats halfway through and put on your expert hat. So yeah, nothing that's really surprised me, but it is quite disappointing that it's just going for that how low did things get angle. The questions will tend to be, when did you start, how bad did it get, when did you stop, and that's it. So there's a real lack of imagination. I think we could be asking people with lived experience questions about how they survived, you know, so about their resilience, and about, you know, how they're sort of living their life now.
My question now is, how did you hope for the narrative to be in the media for the coverage of your book?
Well, ideally, I'd really like to open more of a conversation about why people take drugs. I'd like to see acknowledgement that many people take drugs without any issues at all. You never hear that. So they're non-gendered things. As for the gendered things, I'd really like to talk about the fact that men and women experience pathways into drugs and their life within drug use and pathways out of drugs very differently, because women tend to sort of get treated as mini men, you know, as if we've all got the same experience. So there's a real lack of understanding there, I think.
Ah, yes, my next question. So in your book, you talk a lot about substances, from alcohol, tobacco, crack, speed, etc. Do you feel that this made it harder for the media to put you or the book into a box? For example, from newspapers, we're told that people who use cannabis are lazy stoners, those who use crack are non-white minorities, and those who use heroin are your slim, potentially with no fixed abode, white males.
Yeah.
These are very brief stereotypes, but with your book, you cover so much that I don't know whether, do you think the media struggled with this? Because it wasn't an easy tick, I know what box to put Jenny in.
Well, it's quite interesting, actually, because they mainly just focused on alcohol with regards to me. That's despite me having, you know, talked about smoking crack and heroin and speed being my drug of choice. Hardly anyone mentioned that. And I don't know why. Isn't that interesting? It's like saying, well, we do tend to other drug users in our stories, as in other, in inverted commas, we do tend to other people who take drugs, but we can't do that with this person because we're sort of collaborating with them to write a story. So maybe we'll just focus on the alcohol. I mean, I should really ask people who interview me, but I do find it fascinating that I've been portrayed as this alcoholic, you know, rather than somebody who dabbled in all sorts.
Yeah, I do find that interesting because you'd think that a non-legal substance would carry more weight.
I don't know why. Maybe it's because the book is really, my story is very every woman. You know, it's not like I lose everything and I'm found in an alley somewhere with a needle hanging out of my arm. So maybe journalists want to use it to kind of awaken the fears in their female drinking audience. That's entirely possible, actually.
Yeah, that is very true. Yeah, good point. Okay, so you speak in your book on the choice of language that you use and how different countries adopt for different turns of phrases, where it be more harm minimization or more harm reduction, a choice of language, and then more specifically how the media speaks in this language. Could you speak more to the stigmatizing words that have cropped up with your, I guess, relationship or experience with the media in this book, and why shouldn't they be using them?
There's just no consensus on language, is there? Because it depends what country you're in. It depends what kind of treatment path you work in or are following. But I talk about the fact that I really dislike labels. So, you know, I dislike addict and alcoholic and, you know, God forbid, junkie. I know some people like to use them with regard to themselves, and I totally respect that. They usually have their reasons, you know, whether it be a reminder from where I came from, or you know, it bonds me with other people in this group. But I think only the individual should be allowed to use them, first of all. You know, it's definitely not down to the general public or the media to call people addicts or alcoholics. The reason I find it difficult is because it basically puts us in this box. So you're now just an alcoholic, which completely disregards all, you know, the other facets of your personality and the fact that you might not be an alcoholic forever. Not to mention the fact that alcoholic and addict aren't even clinical terms. So what exactly do they mean? And it's also really odd, I think, that anybody who puts up their hand for help with their drug or alcohol use immediately goes from being okay to, right, you're now an alcoholic or addict. And a lot of that obviously trickles down from the huge impact that 12-step AA and NA has had on popular culture. So everyone's familiar with the language of addict and alcoholic. But it disregards the fact that there are really complex factors that underpin our use. So, you know, we know that environment and upbringing and various genetic things contribute to, and trauma contribute to, why we ended up where we did. So just to call yourself an addict or an alcoholic is to kind of disregard all those.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you've mentioned again in your book about how drugs are complex and that the problem is, you know, commonly minimized to the drug. Why do you think that the media misses all this chunk out? Is it literally due to like word limit or because they think that no one's interested? What, like, because things are so complex, I would suggest that it would be more interesting that way. But
yeah. I mean, most media stories are reductive. There is a word count. They've got to get to the point. So So, you know, we mentioned earlier the group I'm a part of, AOD Media Watch. We actually contacted a few journalists, particularly journalists for the broadsheets, which should be more careful. And they said, look, we're not going to use person-centered language like person experiencing problematic substance use, because if we use addict, then, you know, that's one word instead of five or six. And they were quite stubborn about that, you know, and it does read kind of annoyingly when you see that person-centered language. It is very academic and intellectual. I understand that. But I think it's so reductive to just use addict and alcoholic as if there's nothing more to a person and that you're just adhering to the fact that they are genetically bound to this drug forever and can never be free of it.
Do you think that there's an argument for impact as well as word count that they'd use these words?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, good point. Yeah, I mean, it definitely presses the buttons, doesn't it, to use druggy or junkie or addict. It gives us a thrill reading it. It gives us a vicarious thrill. And, you know, this idea of goodies and baddies and heroes and villains. And, okay, we understand this story. We understand where it's going. It's familiar to us.
Yeah, absolutely. Your book focuses on women in substances and the gender divide in substance use. Focusing again on the media reception, do you think that your narrative may have been shaped differently if the book was Man of Substances? Or do you think that both genders received similar stigmatization in the media regarding drugs?
I think women get judged more harshly if they're mothers, for instance. You know, there's a real... I think there are a few media tropes for women that I can identify. One is the slovenly mother, and she's like our dumping ground for disgust. You know, she's the sort of person we put in the town square and boo and hurl fruit at. And then there's like the party girl, who's the girl that we fetishize on the front page when she dies after taking a pill. And she's normally from a good home, and she's blonde, and someone will swear blind that she never took a pill before in her life. And then the other one I'd say is like the fallen middle class woman. And it's, you know, she'll come from maybe a renowned family, and it's kind of this how the mighty have fallen kind of jeering. So that's how women get treated. With men, it tends to be the more the hardened criminal kind of pointy edge of news stories. You know, you tend to hear about bikies, or they're called bikies in Australia, bikers and, you know, the criminal element. So I don't think you're going to hear so much about somebody who's just really struggled. I can say, though, that the original publisher I went to, the book publisher, he envisaged that my face would be on the cover. This despite me saying from the start, I'm not going to have my face on the cover. He said, no, I think, you know, I've got this great idea. It's going to be a real close-up. And your face will be contorted in anguish, and you'll have your mascara smudged and your lipstick smeared. And I was thinking, that's kind of like a post-rape image or something, you know, or at least something really traumatizing has happened. And you'd never do that to a guy if he'd written this book. I mean, the equivalent would be asking your male author to pose in a gutter having wet his pants or something. It's just really odd. It's like, why on earth would I agree to that?
Yeah, that's true. My question is, I can imagine that raising the extent of gender differences in research and treatment in your book was quite a surprise to some readers. Could you speak more as to why the addiction treatment industry is geared towards men and why women are left behind?
Historically, well, if you think about it, it's quite hard for a lot of women to access treatment now because there's a lot of stigma around if you're a mum and you've been using drugs and alcohol. And there always will be, no doubt. But if you go back for the decades, that stigma would have been more and more and more extreme. So any sort of rehabs or detoxes or 12-step programs have been designed for the male experience until very, very recently. Some have adapted and most haven't. So it's treated as though men are still the norm, and that, as if women are just mini men, and that you can treat women the same way that you would your main male cohort. And that's not true. There's a massive study in Australia in 2016, just looking at alcohol. And what it did was it pulled the data from about, I think it was 68 studies worldwide, and it found that not only are men and women drinking equally now, but women who were born after 1981, on average, are drinking more than men. So we're really kind of, we haven't caught up with the fact that addiction is just as much a problem for women as men. It may be true that fewer women access treatment for the reasons I gave of, you know, barriers to treatment. But for those that do access treatment, it's not enough to just put them into so-called gender-neutral programs and expect them to thrive, because often they'll have had extremely different experiences. They might have experienced domestic violence. They might have experienced sexual assault. I mean, probably both those things. And women's experiences of drug use in general are just very different. Their pathways in are different. So it's not good enough to have a gender-neutral service. You either need gender-sensitive services, which take into account trauma and don't force someone to share that trauma in a mixed group, which happens a lot. We need more women-only services, it could be argued.
Okay, yeah. And in your book, you experienced, when you went to AA, you experienced a mixed group and a women-only group. Did you feel that you thrived better in the women-only group than the mixed?
Yeah, I definitely did. I wrote this chapter in the book called A Word from My Sponsor, and it's about AA. And because I haven't gone for years and years and years, I thought I should give someone from AA a right of reply. So my former sponsor kind of makes these interjections all the way through. And I talk about the fact that, you know, there's a lot of sexual tension in groups, and women don't necessarily feel comfortable making themselves feel vulnerable in front of men when they've experienced certain things. And my sponsor interjected, I think this has got more to do with you and your relationship with men. And she was being smart, but she's got a good point, actually. You know, my experience with men had been really quite bad. If you look at all the accumulated experiences under the effects of drugs and alcohol, or even from being a child, being in a mixed group for me felt very unsafe. But that would apply to a lot of women who reach the point where they need to seek treatment. So I do think you need options. So then I started going to female-only groups, and I found that a lot more my speed. I didn't have to worry about what was going on across the circle, like, you know, trying to avoid eye contact or make eye contact, and who's available, who's not available, all these sort of things that go for your head in early sobriety. And I made some amazing friends there who, you know, 8 or 9 years later, I don't go anymore, but I'm still in constant contact with them. And I know that they know exactly where I'm coming from, and we have quite a similar mindset. So it's really valuable.
You also speak in your book about the gender differences within research in the academic world. Could you speak a little bit more about this and why there is that divide?
Yeah, so males are definitely the low-hanging fruit of research, particularly when it comes to testing medications, for instance, because you don't have to worry about ethics committees as much, because there's no way they can be pregnant. You also don't have to worry about wherever they are in their menstrual cycle, because that would skew results. But they're also the norm when it comes to psychological research around drug use, because, as we've touched on, men have long been seen as the norm. And if you think about it, a lot of current research builds on research that's, you know, been carried out in the past. It's using those stats and then taking that a step further. So we very much have this very male domain. And quite a few female researchers that I spoke to when interviewing them for the book said, either on the record or off the record, that they'd been actively discouraged from researching women by their male superiors, by their male supervisors. So again, you know, hopefully this is changing over time, but across all research, actually, not just drug and alcohol, men are definitely used as the norm. And even trials using rats or mice, they'll almost always use male rats or mice. In fact, there was a Melbourne-based researcher who analysed studies and found that of the studies she looks at, 85%, I think it was, used male rodents. And it's, again, for the same reasons. It's for, you know, it's so they don't have to worry about the menstrual cycle skewing results, and so they don't have to worry about whether or not the rat is pregnant and is skewing the results. But the fact that we know that these things do skew results mean that we need to take them into consideration, because it means that real-life women are also being affected by these things.
And didn't you say in your book as well that there was an example of a specific drug that was used by women, and then they had to either take it off the shelves or something because the women were reacting to it different than what the trials had said on the men?
Well, they were dying.
Oh, there we go, they were dying.
That was Appian. I'm not sure how many deaths there were, it might have been a couple, but it seems as though the deaths were because women respond differently to drugs. It's not just down to our size, it's down to things like we have different enzymes in our stomachs, we have a different, you know, muscle water fat ratio, all sorts of things. Like, we can't just use male data and extrapolate that and apply it to women.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Yeah, has there been any... Is this being known about in the research world? Are people actively trying to change this?
No, there's definitely checks and balances being put into place to make sure that this does change. Particularly, I think it was in the field of heart disease. More women actually suffer from heart disease than men. But it's been observed that, you know, the vast majority of studies are done on men. So there was actually some kind of push that came into place there, I think it was in the 90s, to say this has got to stop, this has got to change.
Good. And when you were writing this book and like finding all the research and literature behind everything of your journey, was it very cathartic writing it and finding all the information out?
No. No, it is now, but no, when writing it, it was really, really awful process, actually, because you definitely haven't popped up out of the other side at the point that you're writing. So there was a hierarchy of worry. You know, am I upsetting my parents? Am I going to be representing the academics poorly? What are people going to think when they read this bit? So it was really tricky. I mean, I did everything I could from the memoir point of view to make sure people in my life were okay. So I gave people who featured in the book, most of them, the chance to read their chapters and respond and change things. And actually nobody changed anything. But even so, yeah, it was a real kind of period of worry. And I had to write 2 chapters a month because I had a very tight deadline. So that was working every day extremely intensely with no time for, you know, what we popularly call self-care. So it wasn't until I'd got the book back from the printer that there was this kind of blissful window of, wow, I've written something that's pretty good, and I feel like I've got it all out of my system. And then that kind of window shut again when I had to talk about it in interviews, which proved to be quite tricky. But yeah, I've now come out the other side again where that's winding up, and it feels like I can say goodbye to that whole 2 decades of struggle. So, I mean, not many people have the opportunity to do that. So I'm really, really fortunate.
Is with your work with Alcohol and Other Drugs Media Watch, and as a journalist as you are now, is there anything that could be done with the media to make it a more gender neutral or positive space for the stories around drug use? Like, what are the aims? I guess, what are the aims of the AOD Media Watch in order to continue working and continue not battling the media, but negotiating and having these open discussions with them?
Yeah, so we're twofold. We do have the kind of the critiquing prong, if you like, but we also offer resources and, you know, want to start conversations. So I think the public in general, not just, you know, groups like ours, needs to hold media accountable. We've all got social media. You can do that. You can look at a story that's stigmatizing, that uses stigmatizing language, or, you know, is pretty outrageous in some other way, and you can respond. And I think that's really positive in this age of, you know, having platforms where everyone's got a voice. I think we've all got a bit of a social responsibility to do that. And I do think slowly but surely the media is changing. You know, it's not just in the area of addiction that people are encouraged to use person-centered language now. It's in the areas of disability and mental health. And slowly but surely, that message is definitely trickling through.
And that was the interview with Jenny Valentich. I hope you enjoyed it. Remember, her book is available on Amazon. You can search Woman of Substances, or you can find the link in this episode's bio. See you next time.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.